To Vecchio, Roy said, "Turn off the gas under that tomato sauce. I'm afraid it's going to burn."
"I swear I've never heard of him," the woman insisted.
Roy was inclined to believe her. Helen of Troy could not have had a nose any finer than Mary Zelinsky's. Of course, indirectly, Helen of Troy had been responsible for the deaths of thousands, and many others had suffered because of her. So beauty was no guarantee of innocence. And in the tens of centuries since the time of Helen, human beings had become masters at the concealment of evil. So even the most guileless-looking creatures sometimes proved to be depraved. Roy had to be sure, so he said, "If I feel you're lying to me..."
"I'm not lying,"
Mary said tremulously. He held up one hand to silence her, and he continued where he had been interrupted. "I might take this precious girl to her room, undress her..." The woman closed her eyes tightly in horror, as if she could block out the scene that he was so delicately describing for her. "And there, among the teddy bears and dolls, I could teach her some grown-up games." The woman's nostrils flared with terror. Hers really was an exquisite nose. "Now, Mary, look me in the eyes," he said, "and tell me again if you know a man named Spencer Grant." She opened her eyes and met his gaze. They were face to face. He put one hand on the child's head, stroked her hair, smiled. Mary Zelinsky clutched her daughter with pitiful desperation.
"I swear to God, I never heard of him. I don't know him. I don't understand what's happening here."
"I believe you," he said. "Rest easy, Mary. I believe you, dear lady. I'm sorry it was necessary to resort to such crudity." Though the tone of his voice was tender and apologetic, a tide of rage washed through Roy. His fury was directed at Grant, who had somehow hoodwinked them, not at this woman or her daughter or her hapless husband in the Barker lounger. Although Roy strove to repress his anger, the woman must have glimpsed it in his eyes, which were ordinarily of such a kindly aspect, for she flinched from him. At the stove, where he had turned off the gas under the sauce and under a pot of boiling water as well, Vecchio said, "He doesn't live here anymore."
"I don't think he ever did," Roy said tightly.
Spencer took two suitcases from the closet, considered them, put the smaller of the two aside, and opened the larger bag on his bed. He selected enough clothes for a week. He didn't own a suit, a white shirt, or even one necktie. In his closet hung half a dozen pairs of blue jeans, half a dozen pairs of tan chinos, khaki shirts, and denim shirts. In the top drawer of the highboy, he kept four warm sweaters, two blue, two green, and he packed one of each. While Spencer filled the suitcase, Rocky paced from room to room, standing worried sentry duty at every window he could reach. The poor mutt was having a hard time shaking off the nightmare. Leaving his men to watch over the Zelinsky family, Roy stepped out of the house and crossed the street toward his car. The twilight had darkened from red to deep purple. The street lamps had come on. The air was still, and for a moment the silence was almost as deep as if he had been in a country field. They were lucky that the Zelinskys' neighbors had not heard anything to arouse suspicion. On the other hand, no lights showed in the houses flanking the Zelinsky place. Many families in that pleasant middle-class neighborhood were probably able to maintain their standard of living only if both husband and wife held full-time jobs. In fact, in this precarious economy, with take-home pay declining, many were holding on by their fingernails, even with two breadwinners. Now, at the height of the rush hour, two-thirds of the homes on both sides of the street were dark, untenanted. Their owners were battling freeway traffic, picking up their kids at sitters and day schools that they could not easily afford, and struggling to get home to enjoy a few hours of peace before climbing back on the treadmill in the morning. Sometimes Roy was so sensitive to the plight of the average person that he was brought to tears. Right now, however, he could not allow himself to surrender to the empathy that came so easily to him. He had to find Spencer Grant. In the car, after starting the engine and slipping into the passenger seat, he plugged in the attaché case computer. He married the cellular telephone to it. He called Mama and asked her to find a phone number for Spencer Grant in the greater L.A. area. And from the center of her web in Virginia, she began the search. He hoped to get an address for Grant from the phone company, as he had gotten one for the Bettenfields. David Davis and Nella Shire would have left the downtown office for the day, so he couldn't call there to rail at them. In any case, the problem wasn't their fault, though he would have liked to place the blame on Davis. and on Wirtz, whose first name was probably Igor. In a few minutes, Mama reported that no one named Spencer Grant possessed a telephone, listed or unlisted, in the Los Angeles area. Roy didn't believe it. He fully trusted Mama. The problem wasn't with her. She was as faultless as his own dear departed mother had been. But Grant was clever, too damned clever. Roy asked Mama to search telephone company billing records for the same name. Grant might have been listed under a pseudonym, but before providing service, the phone company had surely required the signature of a real person with a good credit history. As Mama worked, Roy watched a car cruise past and pull into a driveway a few houses farther along the street. Night ruled the city. To the far edge of the western horizon, twilight had abdicated. No trace of its royal purple light remained. The display screen flashed dimly, and Roy looked down at the computer on his lap. According to Mama, Spencer Grant's name did not appear in telephone billing records either. First, the guy had gone back into his employment files in the LAPD computer and inserted the Zielinski address, evidently chosen at random, in place of his own. And now, although he still lived in the L.A. area and almost certainly had a telephone, he had expunged his name from the records of whichever company, Pacific Bell or GTE, provided his local service. Grant seemed to be trying to make himself invisible. "Who the hell is this guy?" Roy wondered aloud. Because of what Nella Shire had found, Roy had been convinced that he knew the man he was seeking. Now he suddenly felt that he didn't know Spencer Grant at all, not in any fundamental sense. He knew only generalities, superficialities, but it was in the details where his damnation might lie. What had Grant been doing at the bungalow in Santa Monica? How was he involved with the woman? What did he know? Getting answers to those questions was of increasing urgency. Two more cars disappeared into garages at different houses. Roy sensed that his chances of finding Grant were diminishing with the passage of time. Feverishly, he considered his options, then went through Mama to penetrate the computer at the California Department of Motor Vehicles in Sacramento. In moments, a picture of Grant was on his display screen, one taken by the DMV specifically for a new driver's license. All vital statistics were provided and a street address. "All right," Roy said softly, as if to speak loudly would be to undo this bit of good luck. He ordered and received three printouts of the data on the screen, exited the DMV, said goodbye to Mama, switched off the computer, and went back across the street to the Zielinski house. Mary, Peter, and the daughter sat on the living room sofa. They were pale, silent, holding hands. They looked like three ghosts in a celestial waiting room, anticipating the imminent arrival of their judgment documents, more than half expecting to be served with one-way tickets to hell. Dorman, Johnson, and Vecchio stood guard, heavily armed and expressionless. Without comment, Roy gave them printouts of the new address for Grant that he had gotten from the DMV. With a few questions, he established that both Mary and Peter Zielinski were out of work and on unemployment compensation. That was why they were at home about to have dinner, when most neighbors were still in schools of steel fish on the concrete seas of the freeway system. They had been searching the want ads in the Los Angeles Times every day, applying for new jobs at numerous companies and worrying so unrelentingly about the future that the explosive arrival of Dorman, Johnson, Vecchio, and Roy had seemed on some level not surprising, but a natural progression of their ongoing catastrophe. Roy was prepared to flash his Drug Enforcement Administration ID and to use every technique of intimidation in his repertoire to reduce the Zielinski family to total submission and to ensure that they never filed a complaint either with the local police or with the federal government. However, they were obviously already so cowed by the economic turmoil that had taken their jobs and by city life in general that Roy did not need to provide even phony identification. They would be grateful to escape from this encounter with their lives. They would meekly repair their front door, clean up the mess, and probably conclude that they had been terrorized by drug dealers who had burst into the wrong house in search of a hated competitor. No one filed complaints against drug dealers. Drug dealers in modern America were akin to a force of nature. It made as much sense, and was far safer, to file an angry complaint about a hurricane, a tornado, a lightning storm. Adopting the imperious manner of a cocaine king, Roy warned them, "Unless you want to see what it's like having your brains blown out, better sit still for 10 minutes after we leave. Zielinski, you have a watch? You think you can count off 10 minutes?"
"Yes, sir," Peter Zielinski said.
Mary would not look at Roy. She kept her head down. He could not see much of her splendid nose.
"You know I'm serious?" Roy asked the husband, and was answered with a nod. "Are you going to be a good boy?"
"We don't want any trouble."
"I'm glad to hear that."
The reflexive meekness of these people was a sorry comment on the brutalization of American society. It depressed Roy. On the other hand, their pliability made his job a hell of a lot easier than it otherwise might have been. He followed Dorman Johnson and Vecchio outside, and he was the last to drive away. He glanced repeatedly at the house, but no faces appeared at the door or at any of the windows. Their disaster had been narrowly averted. Roy, who prided himself on his generally even temper, could not remember being as angry with anyone in a long time as he was with Spencer Grant. He couldn't wait to get his hands on the guy. Spencer packed a canvas satchel with several cans of dog food, a box of biscuit treats, a new rawhide bone, Rocky's water and food bowls, and a rubber toy that looked convincingly like a cheeseburger in a sesame seed bun. He stood the satchel beside his own suitcase near the front door. The dog was still checking the windows from time to time, but not as obsessively as before. For the most part, he had overcome the nameless terror that propelled him out of his dream. Now his fear was of a more mundane and quieter variety. The anxiety that always possessed him when he sensed that they were about to do something out of their daily routine. A wariness of change. He padded after Spencer to see if any alarming actions were being taken, returned repeatedly to the suitcase to sniff it, and visited his favorite corners of the house to sigh over them, as though he suspected that he might never have the chance to enjoy their comforts again. Spencer removed a laptop computer from a storage shelf above his desk and put it beside the satchel and suitcase. He'd purchased it in September so he could develop his own programs while sitting on the porch, enjoying the fresh air and the soothing susurration of autumn breezes stirring the eucalyptus grove. Now it would keep him wired into the Great American Info Network during his travels. He returned to his desk and switched on the larger computer. He made floppy disk copies of some of the programs he had designed, including the one that could detect the faint electronic signature of an eavesdropper on a phone line being used for a computer-to-computer dialogue. Another would warn him if, while he was hacking, someone began hunting him down with sophisticated traceback technology. Rocky was at the window again, alternately grumbling and whining softly at the night. At the west end of the San Fernando Valley, Roy drove into hills and across canyons. He was not yet beyond the web of interlocking cities, but there were pockets of primordial blackness between the clustered lights of the suburban blaze. This time he would proceed with more caution than he had shown previously. If the address from the DMV proved to be the home of another family, who, like the Zelinskys, had never heard of Spencer Grant, Roy preferred to find that out before he smashed down their door, terrorized them with guns, ruined the spaghetti sauce that was on the stove, and risked being shot by an irate homeowner who perhaps also happened to be a heavily armed fanatic of one kind or another. In this age of impending social chaos, breaking into a private home, whether behind the authority of a genuine badge or not, was a riskier business than it had once been. The residents might be anything from child-molesting worshippers of Satan to cohabiting serial killers with cannibalistic tendencies, refrigerators full of body parts, and eating utensils prettily hand-carved out of human bones. On the cusp of the millennium, some damned strange people were loose out there in Funhouse America. Following a two-lane road into a dark hollow that was threaded with gossamer fog, Roy began to suspect he wouldn't be confronted with an ordinary suburban house, or with the simple question of whether or not it was occupied by Spencer Grant. Something else awaited him. The blacktop became one lane of loose gravel flanked by sickly palms that had not been trimmed in years and that sported long ruffs of dead fronds. At last it came to a gate in a chain-link fence. The phony pizza shop truck was already there. Its red taillights were refracted by the thin mist. Roy checked his rearview mirror and saw headlights 100 yards behind him, Johnson and Vecchio. He walked to the gate. Cal Dorman was waiting for him. Beyond the chain link, in the headlight-silvered fog, strange machines moved rhythmically in counterpoint to one another, like giant prehistoric birds bobbing for worms in the soil. Wellhead pumps. It was a producing oil field, of which many were scattered throughout Southern California. Johnson and Vecchio joined Roy and Dorman at the gate.
"Oil wells," Vecchio said.
goddamned oil wells, Johnson said.
Just a bunch of goddamned oil wells, Vecchio said.
At Roy's direction, Dorman went to the van to get flashlights and a bolt cutter. It was not just a fake pizza delivery truck, but a well-equipped support unit with all the tools and electronic gear that might be needed in a field operation.
We're going in there? Vecchio asked. Why?
There might be a caretaker's cottage, Roy said. Grant might be an on-site caretaker living here. Roy sensed that they were as anxious as he to avoid being made fools of twice in one evening. Nevertheless, they knew, as he did, that Grant had likely inserted a phony address in his DMV records, and that the chance of finding him in the oil field was between slim and nil. After Dorman snapped the gate chain, they followed the gravel lane, using their flashlights to probe between the seesawing pumps. In places, the previous night's torrential rain had washed away the gravel, leaving mud. By the time they looped through the creaking, squeaking, clicking machinery and returned to the gate without finding a caretaker, Roy had ruined his new shoes. In silence, they cleaned off their shoes as best they could by shuffling their feet in the wild grass beside the lane. While the others waited to be told what to do next, Roy returned to his car. He intended to link with Mama and find another address for Spencer, snake-humping, crap-eating piece of human garbage Grant. He was angry. Which wasn't good. Anger inhibited clear thinking. No problem had ever been solved in a rage. He breathed deeply, inhaling both air and tranquility. With each exhalation, he expelled his tension. He visualized tranquility as a pale peach vapor. He saw tension, however, as a bile-green mist that seethed from his nostrils in twin plumes. From a book of Tibetan wisdom, he had learned this meditative technique of managing his emotions. Maybe it was a Chinese book, or Indian, he wasn't sure. He had explored many Eastern philosophies in his endless search for deeper self-awareness and transcendence. When he got in the car, his pager was beeping. He unclipped it from the sun visor. In the message window, he found the name Kleck and a telephone number in the 714 area code. John Kleck was leading the search for the 9-year-old Pontiac registered to Valerie Keene. If she'd followed her usual pattern, the car had been abandoned in a parking lot or along a city street. When Roy called the number on the pager, the answering voice was unmistakably Kleck's. He was in his 20s, thin and gangly, with a huge Adam's apple and a face resembling that of a trout. But his voice was deep, mellifluous, and impressive. "It's me," Roy said. "Where are you?" The words rolled off Kleck's tongue with sonorous splendor.
John Wayne Airport, down in Orange County.
The search had begun in L.A., but had been widening all day.
The Pontiac's here, in one of the long-term parking garages. We are collecting the names of the airline ticket agents working yesterday afternoon and evening. We've got photographs of her. Someone may remember selling her a ticket.
Follow through, but it's a dead end. She's too smart to dump the car where she made her next connection. It's misdirection. She knows we can't be sure, so we'll have to waste time checking it out.
We're also trying to talk to all the cab drivers who worked the airport during that time. Maybe she didn't fly out, but took a taxi.
Better carry it one step further. She might have walked from the airport to one of the hotels around there. See if any doormen, parking valets, or bellmen remember her asking for a cab.
Will do, Kleck said. She's not going to get far this time, Roy. We're going to stay right on her ass.
Roy might have been reassured by Kleck's confidence and by the rich timbre of his voice if he hadn't known that Kleck looked like a fish trying to swallow a cantaloupe. Later, he hung up. He married the phone to the attaché case computer, started the car, and linked with Mama in Virginia. He gave her a daunting task, even considering her considerable talents and connections. Search for Spencer Grant in the computerized records of water and power companies, gas companies, tax collectors' offices. In fact, search the electronic files of every state, county, regional, and city agency, as well as those of any company regulated by any public agency in Ventura, Kern, Los Angeles, Orange, San Diego, Riverside, and San Bernardino counties. Furthermore, access customer records of every banking institution in California. Their checking, savings, loan, and credit card accounts. On a national level, search Social Security Administration and Internal Revenue Agency files, beginning with California and working eastward state by state. Finally, after indicating that he would call in the morning for the results of Mama's investigation, he closed the electronic door in Virginia. He switched off his computer. The fog was growing thicker and the air chiller by the minute. The three men were still waiting for him by the gate, shivering. "We might as well wrap it up for tonight," Roy told them. "Get a fresh start in the morning." They looked relieved. Who knew where Grant might send them next? Roy slapped their backs and gave them cheerful encouragement as they returned to their vehicles. He wanted them to feel good about themselves. Everyone had a right to feel good about himself. In his car, reversing along the gravel to the two-lane blacktop, Roy breathed deeply, slowly. In with the pale peach vapor of blessed tranquility, out with the bile green mist of anger, tension, stress. Peach in, green out, peach in. He was still furious. Because they had eaten a late lunch, Spencer drove along a long stretch of barren Mojave all the way to Barstow before pulling off Interstate 15 and stopping for dinner. At the drive-thru window of a McDonald's, he ordered a Big Mac, fries, and a small vanilla milkshake for himself. Rather than fuss with the cans of dog food in the canvas satchel, he also ordered two hamburgers and a large water for Rocky. Then relented and ordered a second vanilla shake. He parked at the rear of the well-lighted restaurant lot, left the engine running to keep the Explorer warm, and sat in the cargo area to eat, with his back against the front seat and legs stretched out in front of him. Rocky licked his chops in anticipation as the paper bags were opened and the truck filled with wonderful aromas. Spencer had folded down the rear seats before leaving Malibu, so even with the suitcase and other gear, he and the dog had plenty of room. He opened Rocky's burgers and put them on their wrappers. By the time Spencer had extracted his own Big Mac from its container and had taken a single bite, Rocky had wolfed down the meat patties that he'd been given and most of one bun, which was all the bread he wanted. He gazed yearningly at Spencer's sandwich, and he whined. "Mine," Spencer said. Rocky whined again, not a frightened whine, not a whine of pain. It was a whine that said, "Oh, look at poor cute me, and realize how much I'd like that hamburger and cheese and special sauce and maybe even the pickles. Do you understand the meaning of mine?" Rocky looked at the bag of French fries in Spencer's lap. "Mine." The dog looked dubious. "Yours," Spencer said, pointing to the uneaten hamburger bun. Rocky sorrowfully regarded the dry bun, then the juicy Big Mac. After taking another bite and washing it down with some vanilla milkshake, Spencer checked his watch. "We'll gas up and be back on the interstate by 9 o'clock. It's about 160 miles to Las Vegas. Even without pushing hard, we can make it by midnight." Rocky was fixated on the French fries again. Spencer relented and dropped four of them onto one of the burger wrappers. "You ever been to Vegas?" he asked. The four fries had vanished. Rocky stared longingly at the others that bristled from the bag in his master's lap. "It's a tough town. And I got a bad feeling that things are going to get nasty for us real fast once we get there." Spencer finished his sandwich, fries, and milkshake, sharing no more of anything in spite of the mutt's reproachful expression. He gathered up the paper debris and put it in one of the bags. "I want to make this clear to you, pal. Whoever's after her, that damn powerful, dangerous, trigger-happy, on edge, the way they shot at Shadows last night, must be a lot at stake for them." Spencer took the lid off the second vanilla milkshake, and the dog cocked his head with interest. "See what I saved for you? Now, aren't you ashamed of thinking bad thoughts about me when I wouldn't give you more fries?" Spencer held the container so Rocky wouldn't tip it over. The dog attacked the milkshake with the fastest tongue west of Kansas City, consuming it in a frenzy of lapping, and in seconds his snout went deep into the cup in quest of the swiftly vanishing treat. "If they had that house under observation last night, maybe they have a photograph of me." Withdrawing from the cup, Rocky stared curiously at Spencer. The mutt's snout was smeared with milkshake. "You have disgusting table manners." Rocky stuck his snout back in the cup, and the Explorer was filled with the slurping noises of canine gluttony. "If they have a photo, they'll find me eventually, and trying to get a lead on Valerie by going back into her past, I'm liable to blunder across a tripwire and call attention to myself." The cup was empty, and Rocky was no longer interested in it. With an amazing extended rotation of his tongue, he licked most of the mess off his snout.
Whoever she's up against, I'm the world's biggest fool to think I can handle him. I know that. I'm acutely aware of that. But here I am, on my way to Vegas, just the same.
Rocky hacked. Milkshake residue was cloying in his throat. Spencer opened the cup of water and held it while the dog drank.
What I'm doing, getting involved like this, it's not really fair to you. I'm aware of that, too.
Rocky wanted no more water. His entire muzzle was dripping. After capping the water again, Spencer put it in the bag of trash. He picked up a handful of paper napkins and took Rocky by the collar.
Come here, slob.
Rocky patiently allowed his snout and chin to be blotted dry. Eye to eye with the dog, Spencer said,
You're the best friend I have. You know that? Of course you know. I'm the best friend you have, too. And if I get myself killed, who will take care of you?
The dog solemnly met Spencer's gaze, as if aware that the issue at hand was important.
Don't tell me you can take care of yourself. You're better than when I took you in, but you're not self-sufficient yet. You probably never will be.
The dog chuffed, as if to disagree, but they both knew the truth.
If anything happens to me, I think you'll come apart, revert, be like you were in the pound. And who else will ever give you the time and attention you'll need to come back again? Nobody.
He let go of the collar.
So I want you to know I'm not as good a friend to you as I ought to be. I want to have a chance with this woman. I want to find out if she's special enough to care about someone like me. I'm willing to risk my life to find that out, but I shouldn't be willing to risk yours, too.
Never lie to the dog.
I don't have it in me to be as faithful a friend as you can be. I'm just a human being, after all. Look deep inside any of us, you'll find a selfish bastard.
Rocky wagged his tail.
Stop that. You're trying to make me feel even worse?
With his tail swishing furiously back and forth, Rocky clambered into Spencer's lap to be petted.
Spencer sighed. Well, I'll just have to avoid getting killed.
Never lie to the dog.
Though I think the odds are against me, he added.
In the suburban maze of the valley once more, Roy Muro cruised through a series of commercial districts. On the shore, where one community ended and the next began, he was still angry, but also on the edge of a depression. With increasing desperation, he sought a convenience store where he could expect to find a full array of newspaper vending machines. He needed a special newspaper. Interestingly, in two widely separated neighborhoods, he passed what he was certain were two sophisticated surveillance operations. The first was being conducted out of a tricked-up van with an extended wheelbase and chrome-plated wire wheels. The side of the vehicle had been decorated with an airbrush mural of palm trees, waves breaking on a beach, and a red sunset. Two surfboards were strapped to the luggage rack on the roof. To the uninitiated, it might appear to belong to a surf gypsy who'd won the lottery. The clues to the van's real purpose were apparent to Roy. All glass on the vehicle, including the windshield, was heavily tinted, but two large windows on the side, around which the mural wrapped, were so black that they had to be two-way mirrors disguised with a layer of tinted film on the exterior, making it impossible to see inside, but providing agents in the van, and their video cameras, a clear view of the world beyond. Four spotlights were side by side on the roof above the windshield. None was lit, but each bulb was seated in a cone-shaped fixture, like a small megaphone, which might have been a reflector that focused the beam forward, although, in fact, it was no such thing. One cone would be the antenna for a microwave transceiver linked to computers inside the van, allowing high volumes of encoded data to be received and sent from or to more than one communicant at a time. The remaining three cones were collection dishes for directional microphones. One unlit spotlight was turned not toward the front of the van, as it should have been and as the other three were, but toward a busy sandwich shop, Submarine Dive, across the street. The agents were recording the jumble of conversations among the 8 or 10 people socializing on the sidewalk in front of the place. Later, a computer would analyze the host of voices. It would isolate each speaker, identify him with a number, associate one number with another based on word flow and inflection, delete most background noise, such as traffic and wind, and record each conversation as a separate track.
The second surveillance operation was a mile from the first on a cross street. It was being run out of a van disguised as a commercial vehicle that supposedly belonged to a glass and mirror company called Jerry's Glass Magic. Two-way mirrors were featured boldly on the side, incorporated into the fictitious company's logo. Roy was always gladdened to see surveillance teams, especially super high-tech units, because they were likely to be federal rather than local. Their discreet presence indicated that somebody cared about social stability and peace in the streets. When he saw them, he usually felt safer and less alone. Tonight, however, his spirits were not lifted. Tonight he was caught in a whirlpool of negative emotions. Tonight he could not find solace in the surveillance teams, in the good work he was doing for Thomas Somerton, or in anything else that this world had to offer. He needed to locate his center, open the door in his soul, and stand face to face with the cosmic. Before he spotted a 7-Eleven or any other convenience store, Roy saw a post office, which had what he needed. In front of it were 10 or 12 battered newspaper vending machines. He parked at a red curb, left the car, and checked the machines. He wasn't interested in the Times or the Daily News. What he required could be found only in the alternative press. Most such publications sold sex, focusing on swinging singles, mate-swapping couples, gays, or on adult entertainment and services. He ignored the salacious tabloids. Sex would never suffice when the soul sought transcendence. Many large cities supported a weekly New Age newspaper that reported on natural foods, holistic healing, and spiritual matters, ranging from reincarnation therapy to spirit channeling. Los Angeles had three. Roy bought them all and returned to the car. By the dim glow of the ceiling light, he flipped through each publication, scanning only the space ads and classifieds. Gurus, swamis, psychics, tarot card readers, acupuncturists, herbalists to movie stars, channelers, aura interpreters, palm readers, chaos theory dice counselors, past life guides, high colonic therapists, and other specialists offered their services in heartening numbers. Roy lived in Washington, D.C., but his work took him all over the country. He had visited all the sacred places where the land, like a giant battery, accumulated vast stores of spiritual energy. Santa Fe, Taos, Woodstock, Key West, Spirit Lake, Meteor Crater, and others. He'd had moving experiences in those hallowed confluences of cosmic energy, yet he had long suspected that Los Angeles was an undiscovered nexus as powerful as any. Now the sheer plentitude of consciousness-raising guides in the ads strengthened his suspicion. From the myriad choices, Roy selected The Place of the Way in Burbank. He was intrigued that they had capitalized every word in the name of their establishment, instead of using lowercase for the preposition and second article. They offered numerous methods for seeking the self and finding the eye of the universal storm. Not from a shabby storefront, but from the peaceful sphere of our home. He also liked the proprietors' names, and that they were thoughtful enough to identify themselves in their ad. Guinevere and Chester. He checked his watch past 9 o'clock. Still parked illegally in front of the post office, he called the number in the ad. A man answered.
"This is Chester at the Place of the Way. How may I assist you?"
Roy apologized for calling at that hour, since the Place of the Way was located in their home, but he explained that he was slipping into a spiritual void and needed to find firm ground as quickly as possible. He was grateful to be assured that Chester and Guinevere fulfilled their mission at all hours. After he received directions, he estimated that he could be at their door by 10 o'clock. He arrived at 9:50. The attractive two-story Spanish house had a tile roof and deep-set leaded windows. In the artful landscape lighting, lush palms and Australian tree ferns threw mysterious shadows against pale yellow stucco walls. When Roy rang the bell, he noticed an alarm company sticker on the window next to the door. A moment later, Chester spoke to him from an intercom box.
"Who's there, please?"
Roy was only mildly surprised that an enlightened couple like this, in touch with their psychic talents, found it necessary to take security precautions. Such was the sorry state of the world in which they lived. Even mystics were marked for mayhem. Smiling and friendly, Chester welcomed Roy into the Place of the Way. He was pot-bellied, about 50, mostly bald but with a Friar Tuck fringe of hair, deeply tanned in midwinter, bearish and strong-looking in spite of his gut. He wore rock sports, khaki slacks, and a khaki shirt with the sleeves rolled to expose thick, hairy forearms. Chester led Roy through rooms with yellow pine floors buffed to a high polish, Navajo rugs and rough-hewn furniture that looked more suitable to a lodge in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains than to a home in Burbank. Beyond the family room, which boasted a giant screen TV, they entered a vestibule, and then a round room that was about 12 feet in diameter, with white walls and no windows other than the round skylight in the domed ceiling. A round pine table stood in the center of the round room. Chester indicated a chair at the table. Roy sat. Chester offered a beverage.
Anything from Diet Coke to herbal tea.
But Roy declined because his only thirst was of the soul. In the center of the table was a basket of plaited palm leaves, which Chester indicated.
I'm only an assistant in these matters. Guinevere is the spiritual adept. Her hands must never touch money. Though she's transcended earthly concerns, she must eat, of course.
Of course, Roy said. From his wallet, Roy extracted $300 and put the cash in the basket. Chester seemed to be pleasantly surprised by the offering, but Roy had always believed that a person could expect only the quality of enlightenment for which he was willing to pay. Chester left the room with the basket. From the ceiling, pin spots had washed the walls with arcs of white light. Now they dimmed until the chamber filled with shadows and a moody amber radiance that approximated candlelight.
Hi, I'm Guinevere. No, please, don't get up.
Breezing into the room with girlish insouciance, head held high, shoulders back, she went around the table to a chair opposite the one in which Roy sat. Guinevere, about 40, was exceedingly beautiful in spite of wearing her long blonde hair in Medusan cascades of cornrows, which Roy disliked. Her jade green eyes flared with inner light, and every angle of her face was reminiscent of every mythological goddess Roy had seen portrayed in classical art. In tight blue jeans and a snug white T-shirt, her lean and supple body moved with fluid grace, and her large breasts swayed alluringly. He could see the points of her nipples straining against her cotton shirt.
"How you doing?" she asked perkily.
"Not so good."
"We'll fix that. What's your name?"
"Roy."
"What are you seeking, Roy?"
"I want a world with justice and peace, a world that's perfect in every way, but people are flawed. There's so little perfection anywhere. Yet I want it so badly. Sometimes I get depressed."
"You need to understand the meaning of the world's imperfection and your own obsession with it. What road of enlightenment do you prefer to take?"
"Any road, all roads."
"Excellent," said the beautiful Nordic Rastafarian,
with such enthusiasm that her cornrows bounced and swayed and the clusters of red beads dangling from the ends clicked together.
"Maybe we'll start with crystals."
Chester returned, pushing a large wheeled box around the table to Guinevere's right side. Roy saw that it was a gray and black metal tool cabinet, 4 feet high, 3 feet wide, 2 feet deep, with doors on the bottom third and drawers of various widths and depths above the doors. The Sears Craftsman logo gleamed dully in the amber light. While Chester sat in the third and last chair, which was 2 feet to the left and a foot behind the woman, Guinevere opened one of the drawers in the cabinet and removed a crystal sphere slightly larger than a billiard ball. Cupping it in both hands, she held it out to Roy, and he accepted it.
"Oh, your aura's dark, disturbed. Let's clean that up first. Hold this crystal in both hands, close your eyes, seek a meditative calm. Think about only one thing, only this clean image. Hills covered with snow, gently rolling hills with fresh snow, whiter than sugar, softer than flour. Gentle hills to all horizons, hills upon hills, mantled with new snow, white on white under a white sky, snowflakes drifting down, whiteness through whiteness, over whiteness on whiteness."
Guinevere went on like that for a while, but Roy couldn't see the snow-mantled hills or the falling snow, regardless of how hard he tried.
Instead, in his mind's eye, he could see only one thing. Her hands, her lovely hands, her incredible hands.
She was altogether so spectacular-looking that he hadn't noticed her hands until she was passing the crystal ball to him. He had never seen hands like hers. Exceptional hands. His mouth went dry at the mere thought of kissing her palms, and his heart pounded fiercely at the memory of her slender fingers. They had seemed perfect.
"Okay, that's better," Guinevere said cheerily after a time. "Your aura's much lighter. You can open your eyes now."
He was afraid that he had imagined the perfection of her hands, and that when he saw them again he would discover that they were no different from the hands of other women, not the hands of an angel after all. Oh, but they were... delicate, graceful, ethereal. They took the crystal ball from him, returned it to the open drawer of the tool cabinet, and then gestured, like the spreading wings of doves, to 7 new crystals that she had placed on a square of black velvet in the center of the table while his eyes had been closed.
"Arrange these in any pattern that seems appropriate to you," she said, "and then I'll read them."
The objects appeared to be half-inch-thick crystal snowflakes that had been sold as Christmas ornaments. None was like another. As Roy tried to focus on the task before him, his gaze kept sliding surreptitiously to Guinevere's hands. Each time he glimpsed them, his breath caught in his throat. His own hands were trembling, and he wondered if she noticed. Guinevere progressed from crystals to the reading of his aura through prismatic lenses, to tarot cards, to runestones, and her fabulous hands became ever more beautiful. Somehow he answered her questions, followed instructions, and appeared to be listening to the wisdom that she imparted. She must have thought him dim-witted or drunk, because his speech was thick and his eyelids drooped as he became increasingly intoxicated by the sight of her hands. Roy glanced guiltily at Chester, suddenly certain that the man, perhaps Guinevere's husband, was angrily aware of the lascivious desire that her hands engendered. But Chester wasn't paying attention to either of them. His bald head was bowed, and he was cleaning the fingernails of his left hand with the fingernails of his right. Roy was convinced that the Mother of God could not have had hands more gentle than Guinevere's, nor could the greatest succubus in hell have had hands more erotic. Guinevere's hands were to her what Melissa Wickland's sensuous lips were to her. Oh, but 1,000 times more so, 10,000 times more so. Perfect, perfect, perfect. She shook the bag of runes and cast them again. Roy wondered if he dared ask for a palm reading. She would have to hold his hands in hers. He shivered at that delicious thought, and a spiral of dizziness spun through him. He could not walk out of that room and leave her to touch other men with those exquisite, unearthly hands. He reached under his suit jacket, drew the Beretta from his shoulder holster, and said, "Chester?" The bald man looked up, and Roy shot him in the face. Chester tipped backwards in his chair, out of sight, and thudded to the floor. The silencer needed to be replaced soon. The baffles were worn from use. The muffled shot had been loud enough to carry out of the room, though fortunately not beyond the walls of the house. Guinevere was gazing at the runestones on the table when Roy shot Chester. She must have been deeply immersed in her reading, for she seemed confused when she looked up and saw the gun. Before she could raise her hands in defense and force Roy to damage them, which was unthinkable, he shot her in the forehead. She crashed backward in her chair, joining Chester on the floor. Roy put the gun away, got up, went around the table. Chester and Guinevere stared, unblinking, at the skylight and the infinite night beyond. They had died instantly, so the scene was almost bloodless. Their deaths had been quick and painless. The moment, as always, was sad and joyous. Sad because the world had lost 2 enlightened people who were kind of heart and deep-seeing. Joyous because Guinevere and Chester no longer had to live in a society of the unenlightened and uncaring. Roy envied them. He withdrew his gloves from an inside coat pocket and dressed his hands for the tender ceremony ahead. He tipped Guinevere's chair back onto its feet. Holding her in it, he pushed the chair to the table, wedging the dead woman in a seated position. Her head flopped forward, chin on her breast, and her cornrows rattled softly, falling like a beaded curtain to conceal her face. He lifted her right arm, which hung at her side, and put it on the table, then her left. Her hands... For a while he stared at her hands, which were as appealing in death as in life, graceful, elegant, radiant.
They gave him hope. If perfection could exist anywhere, in any form, no matter how small, even in a pair of hands, then his dream of an entirely perfect world might one day be realized. He put his own hands atop hers. Even through his gloves, the contact was electrifying. He shuddered with pleasure. Dealing with Chester was more difficult because of his greater weight. Nevertheless, Roy managed to move him around the table until he was opposite Guinevere, but slumped in his own chair rather than in the one Roy had been using. In the kitchen, Roy explored the cabinets and pantry, collecting what he needed to finish the ceremony. He looked in the garage as well for the final implement he required. Then he carried those items to the round room and placed them atop the wheeled chest in which Guinevere stored her divining aids. He used a dish towel to wipe off the chair in which he had been sitting, for at the time he had not been wearing gloves and might have left fingerprints. He also buffed that side of the table, the crystal ball, and the snowflake crystals that he had arranged earlier for the psychic reading. He had touched nothing else in the room. For a few minutes he pulled open drawers and doors in the tool chest, examining the magical contents, until he found an item that seemed appropriate to the circumstances. It was a pentalfa, also called a pentagram, in green on a field of black felt, used in more serious matters, such as an attempted communication with the spirits of the dead, than the mere reading of runes, crystals, and tarot cards. Unfolded, it was an 18-inch square. He placed it in the center of the table as a symbol of the life beyond this one. He plugged in the small electric reciprocating saw that he had found among the tools in the garage, and he relieved Guinevere of her right hand. Gently, he placed the hand in a rectangular Tupperware container on another soft dish towel that he had arranged as a bed for it. He snapped the lid on the container. Although he wanted to take her left hand, too, he felt that it would be selfish to insist on possessing both. The right thing was to leave one with the body, so the police and coroner and mortician and everyone else who dealt with Guinevere's remains would know that she'd possessed the most beautiful hands in the world. He lifted Chester's arms onto the table. He placed the dead man's right hand over Guinevere's left, on top of the pentalfa, to express his conviction that they were together in the next world. Roy wished he had the psychic power or purity or whatever was required to be able to channel the spirits of the dead. He would have channeled Guinevere there and then to ask if she would really mind if he acquired her left hand as well. He sighed, picked up the Tupperware container, and reluctantly left the round room. In the kitchen, he phoned 911 and spoke to the police operator. "The place of the way is just a place now. It's very sad. Please come." Leaving the telephone off the hook, he snatched another dish towel from a drawer and hurried to the front door. As far as he could recall, when he had first entered the house and followed Chester to the round room, he had touched nothing. Now he needed only to wipe the doorbell push and drop the dish towel on the way to his car. He drove out of Burbank, over the hills, into the Los Angeles basin, through a seedy section of Hollywood. The bright splashes of graffiti on walls and highway structures, the cars full of young thugs cruising in search of trouble, the pornographic bookstores and movie theaters, the empty shops and the littered gutters and the other evidence of economic and moral collapse, the hatred and envy and greed and lust that thickened the air more effectively than the smog. None of that dismayed him for the time being, because he carried with him an object of such perfect beauty that it proved there was a powerful and wise creative force at work in the universe. He had evidence of God's existence secured in a Tupperware container. Out on the vast Mojave, where the night ruled, where the works of humankind were limited to the dark highway and the vehicles upon it, where the radio reception of distant stations was poor, Spencer found his thoughts drawn against his will to the deeper darkness and even stranger silence of that night 16 years in the past. Once captured in that loop of memory, he could not escape until he had purged himself by talking about what he had seen and endured. The barren plains and hills provided no convenient taverns to serve as confessionals. The only sympathetic ears were those of the dog. Bare-chested and barefoot, I descend the stairs, shivering, rubbing my arms,
wondering why I'm so afraid. Perhaps even at that moment I dimly realize that I'm going down to a place from which I'll never be able to ascend. I'm drawn forward by the cry that I heard while leaning out the window to find the owl. Although it was brief and came just twice, and then only faintly, it was so piercing and pathetic that the memory of it bewitches me, the way a 14-year-old boy can sometimes be seduced as easily by the prospect of strangeness and terror as by the mysteries of sex.